Welcome to Ordain and Establish, a podcast of the Center for the Constitution and the Catholic Intellectual Tradition at Catholic University. To learn more, visit our website at cit.catholic.edu.
So what we're going to do for the next little over an hour or so is look at, according to our schedule, our sheet, the cardinal virtues, the theological virtues, and then we will pivot to the necessity of grace. So this is the your readings. You've looked at questions 61 through 62 of the Prima Secundae, which in Latin is simply the first part of the second part, and that's found on pages 106 to 119 of your reader. And then we will look at the Prima Secundae Yend, question 109, which is the introductory question on grace, and that's found in the supplement on pages 28 to 43. And Dr. Elliott and Kevin have pointed out to focus on, and they have all. Very Trezian, but I choose all. So we will focus on all, and it's very nice, and I'm very grateful to them. David has taken the Herculean burden of looking at many questions with many articles, and they have given me a few so we can look at them with more specificity. And so just as by way of preface too, I use the whiteboard not because I want to be imposing or I want to be condescending, but I think visualization helps. So that's why I do this. And I'm also not as technologically talented as Dr. Elliott, who could do these. I'm looking, he has on the screen here his outline of the factors of humans. So I don't know how to do that, but I can draw four images on the board. So just with the context of what we talked about yesterday, I'll use this side because I know there's a monitor there that kind of blocks it. So with regard to the human person, with regard to the end, of course, this is God. This is the whole movement, context, stage of the moral life. We need Super Doctrina because why? God is a quendam fina. He's a kind of end, which exceeds human natural knowledge. You're called to beatitude of a supernatural sort with God, and therefore God has revealed. That's what Sacra Doctrina is. God's divine revelation in an active sense, God revealing to us that this is where we're going, and because that, as Aquinas said, as we saw yesterday in question one, so that we can order our actions and our intentions. Sacra Doctrina was given so we can order our actions and our intentions to God. What's interesting about that is that in Nietzsche, in a nutshell, so to speak, even in, before we get, this is at the very, again, the very first question of the Summa Theologiae, Aquinas has already provided for us the platform, the train track, the metro line, the runway, or the whole of the moral life, and we're interested in virtues, and today we're going to look at the moral virtues and the theological virtues. But as Professor Elliott's already shown us, it comprises the nature of virtue, the nature of habits, comprise all of these elements: human intention, human action, and yes, human actions are the means through which we have to order our intentions and our actions to God. They are the means that bring us to God or bring us to a desired end, even if that's approximate, much less surfacely, of course, or much more, our ultimate. And we identify the end via intention. So what we see here in the moral life, the kind of a central point of the moral life, moral means human action. And so what we have here is the requirements of human action. No one acts, this is one of the articles you read for yesterday, we look at it specifically, but the end is supreme because no action can begin without an end. And per impossibile, were one to be able to begin an action without a purpose, that action would never be able to come to a terminal point. It would never conclude. Why? Because there'd be no reason, no principle, no state at which we would say, yeah, that act has done what it's supposed to do. The end, the goal, the purpose accounts for an action's very existence, why it happens, and also for its cessation, when it has achieved what it's supposed to do. There is nothing that begins or ends, concludes without an end. And Aquinas is very important, he emphasizes the importance of this because he says, we think of intention and what we're talking about here with regard to, let's call it human rational intention. Why did you do that? Well, why are you doing that? But intentionality permeates the whole of reality. There is no such thing as an endless, purposeless, finality-less, to use a technical word to impress our friends, teleological, absent being. Every being has an end. And the reason why it has to have an end is because we would not be able to define something, to explain what something is without reference to what it does. This is why, if you look at even Aquinas' earlier works, the De Principiis Naturae, on the principles of nature, youthful work, summarizing philosophy of nature, marvelous. He speaks of trees intending to grow. Now, Aquinas does not think that he's living in Alice in Wonderland, well, like plants, or, Hogsworth's castle, or, the Middle Earth, or plants talk. But what he means by that is by growing the tree with its bark, its branches, its roots, its leaves, it's doing what its nature is ordered to. Trees don't begin to talk in this world. They don't fly. They don't lay eggs. What they do is they have acorns, if they're oak trees, etc. They do that. So he speaks about all being as intending. And even the word intend, it means to move towards the end. We see this. So what human action, as the context of virtue and in general, and the moral virtues and the theological virtues specifically, it's speaking of our ability to understand what the end is, the ultimate end, in this case, God, also to be able to understand what the human action's intentionality is, I'll illustrate that in a moment, and how they converge. So to give an example, let's say we're in the middle of the Grand Canyon, big desert, and we have a bunch. We got to get across one of the, there's a place where you could build a bridge over one of the valleys in the Grand Canyon. If you call it a valley, I don't know what you call it, but we got to get across. And let's pretend some of us are masterful engineers. It certainly would not be me as a Dominican friar. We are some of the most impractical people known to man in history. But some of you, let's say, have technological skills. We got to build a bridge. And what we have piles. This is a very strange thought experiment. We have a pile of lumber. We have a pile of iron. We have a pile of plastic. We have a pile of feathers. And we have a pile, or let's say a huge building size reservoir of ice cubes. Now our end is to cross this calf. We have to build a bridge. That's our end. Here, it's not our ultimate end, but it's our proximate end. And we have the capacity to construct a bridge out of any of these material things to make a bridge. We can use wood, we can use iron. Why is that? It's because the intentionality, the nature of wood and iron has a certain solidity, has a certain firmness, has a certain structural strength such that if I apply wood or iron to my end of bridge building, those materials, those elements, those resources can be extended to achieve my end of crossing the chasm. Notice here already, wood and iron are not themselves bridges. So if you were to go to like the iron mill and see all this iron, you would say, wow, you have a lot of bridges around here. No, there's a distinction. However, these material things can be implemented and utilized for the making of a bridge. If we wanted to, however, to use feathers or ice cubes to make a bridge, we could be very sincere, very genuine. I want to make a bridge of ice cubes or out of feathers. That would not work because the nature of feathers, with their finality, their purpose, what they're inclined to, the nature of ice cubes, what they're inclined to, what their nature, their finality, is not conducive to bridge building.
Because obviously, you could build a fridge out of feathers. You might go to get some construct, but the moment you put any weight on it, you're done. And we would all be arguing about who should try this first if we made a bridge out of feathers. So, what that illustration does is it shows that each action has its own nature, it has its own finality, it does something, it has its own order. And each action, therefore, is either ordered to our ultimate further end, in the example, bridge building, here God is our ultimate end, our salvation, but there are some actions which are not in any respect orderable to our ultimate end. These are sinful actions, these are disordered actions. This would be analogous in this illustration. The X actions are like iron and wood. They are orderable to the bridge. And in this case, X is orderable to God. Here, Y actions are disordered away from our end, away from, they're like the feathers or the ice cubes with regard to bridge building, or these are like sinful actions. And here, no matter what our intentionality might be vis-a-vis the end, no matter how sincerely we intend the end, if I knew by unchastity, dishonesty, injustice, I cannot achieve the end. Now, homing in on virtue, because we remember virtue is an interior principle of action, something that affects how we act. What happens is whenever I act for the sake of an end, understanding in my mind, formulated with mind, choice, my intellectual capacity, certain actions as proportioned, conducive to, able to be extended towards the end or not, through repeating those actions began to take up a virtual presence in my powers. So there's a sense which, let's just call these actions truth-telling, because God is the truth, truth is connected to reality, God is pure act. Truth-telling is orderable to God. Lying or theft is not, because that's contradictory to what the end is. And the more, as Professor Elliott has explained, the more I do that, my power becomes shaped by what I do. And if the action is orderable to the end, let's say, see these actions are small x's, let's say God as our end is a big X, the more I act for the sake of an end with regard to actions and means, the ea quae sunt ad finem, those things orderable to the end, my very being, even when I'm not actively operating, begins to take the shape of both the end and the actions I do. So this is why Professor Elliott said, the definition of virtue from Aristotle, which I find very helpful, is that it makes both the action and the actor. It makes both the action and the actor good. In technical, precise, or I should say practical, or precise language, we speak of this, these actions as second act actions. And we speak of our very existence, our acted existence, as first act. Anything that is has first act, by just being. And our first act, because of our nature, is ordered to second act. Namely, those would be things that we do as an actually existing thing. Virtue qualified both of these because it shows that there's an integration between what we do and who we are. So in order for our being and for our actions to be habituated, what we're really looking for now is the powers in which, as Professor Elliott has shown us, that act, and therefore shaped by habitus, which can be virtuous or vicious.
Yes.
Vicious. Now here, it's very important. Virtue is characterized by perfection, perfective. Vice is characterized by defective. This is with regard to the end. What we want to be careful for in our minds is not to think that Thomistic or Aristotelian virtue theory, as it's called today,
is simply a linguistic alternative to what is really the same as Kantian or Kantian deontology. Or it's like, instead of saying being good, doing your duty, we just said be virtuous. Virtue bespeaks the fact that we and our activity, our first act, our existence, our activity, those things we do, they themselves are perfective of us and actually help us achieve what we are made for. Now, as we home in on the moral virtues, I guess here too, and the theological virtues, we have to ask why we have these distinct groups of virtues. And even within the moral virtues, of course, you have these acquired moral virtues and then the infused, as Professor Elliott has already indicated. Why do you have, why do we have these distinctions? Is it arbitrary? And the answer I see in question 61 and 62, and all that Professor Elliott has already outlined, no, there are seven fundamental virtues. Three theological, faith, hope, and charity, and four moral, prudence, justice, fortitude, temperance. And just to make things interesting, those can be activated both naturally and supernaturally. That's why we have acquired moral virtue that fully can do without grace, so to speak, and infuse of what we do with grace. But in order to understand these virtues in their depth, which this is what's underlying what Aquinas has done, we recall the importance of the word object. Now, object is a word that conservatives like, lawyers probably like it too. It's very, you know, straightforward. I don't care what you feel, this is what you did, or this is what the law says. We like that word, but it scares people. And it need not scare people because it is not actually impersonal. It's not a weapon. It bespeaks union and intimacy. Because what is an object? And I say this, we're focusing on this because unless we understand object, we won't understand why there are three theological virtues and why there are four cardinal virtues and how they all integrate, because the principal distinction amongst the virtues is the object or objectivity. So, in order to illustrate this, let's imagine, here we go again with the, here, my famous Dominican House of Study stick figure drawings. We have Kemp. Thank you, Kepa, for volunteering to be a stick figure on our whiteboard. He is here. Beautiful. The resemblance is uncanny. Kevin. Kevin's a rational animal. He's a human person. He has an intellect, he has a will, he has emotions. And Kevin, therefore, has powers, powers of activity, intellect, understanding, thinking, the soul, the will, the rational appetite, as Aquinas even said in these questions, which desires goodness. And then the sense appetites for the emotions which are activated vis-a-vis sensible goods. So that's Kevin. Now we have something called a thing, or in Latin, a res. So make this concrete. Let's imagine, which you don't have to imagine, because I'm sure it's true, that out somewhere in the yards of Catholic University, there's a roller sitting there. At this moment, because we're not out there, we're not touching it, we're not thinking about it, we're not studying it, that rock is just a thing. It truly exists. But Kevin's in here. There's no connection between Kevin and the rock, between Kevin and the thing. That thing, that rock, is just a rock. But let's say Kevin was compelled by either the desire for fresh air, or maybe even by the Holy Spirit, to get up and leave this building. And he goes out, and now he sees, I'm going to draw a circle, that will be the rock. He sees the rock. What has just happened? Has that rock changed in any way? Namely, before Kevin saw the rock, like he walks up and sees it, and after Kevin begins to see the rock, has that rock undergone any change? No. However, is that rock's relationship to Kevin, or let's say Kevin's relationship to that rock,
Is it now different?
Yes.
Because before Kevin was outside looking at the rock, that rock was not activating him in any way. But now that that rock, that thing, is now a scene, it is now an object of his sight. So an object is a thing that is actively activating one of your powers, in this case, the power of sight. So an object is something as it is an activating principle of one of your powers. And that is why we don't chagrin objectivity, because we also notice at the moment that that rock becomes an object of Kevin's sight. It's not just a thing, but it's also both a thing and an object of his sight. It's activated his power of sight. Kevin is now also a subject. He is the one, or his eyes in this case, are the one activated, the powers activated by the thing of Jared. So very important for strict Thomism, there is never, except in God, God's pure object is the subjectivity in God, because subjectivity would require potency, we won't get into that. But on our plane, there is no such thing. On a contingency level, there is no such thing as an object without a subject, because an object is a thing that activates one with a power. And insofar as the power is activated, it is the subject. Now, this rock, this thing, can be the objective of many different powers. We've spoken about the power of sight. But here, let's say Kevin's very eccentric. So I don't just want to look at this rock. We look outside this window and we see Kevin, you know, extending his tongue and tasting the rock. Very strange. But it could do that. What that rock is now doing is that same thing, that same rock that Kevin, that was the object of his sight, now has a different objectivity, because it is now the same thing, but now it's activating a different power. Here we have the power of taste or touch. And although it's the same thing, it's a different object. Taste and sight are not the same kind of acts, because the act of tasting can be of the same thing as the act of seeing, but the act itself is not identical. So this is why Aquinas, with regard to the moral and the theological virtues, emphasizes the objects. Because objects specify actions, which is just the fancy way of saying objects tell us what kind of act this is. What kind of act is this? Well, what's the object? It's seeing. Oh, so the object of this act is seeing a rock. That's what kind of act it is. What's the object? Oh, it's tasting a rock. Very strange. When we come to the moral virtues, what Aquinas is doing then is they're all, we're going to use another stick figure. Kevin, thank you for acting very strangely with the rock. We will now just move to a different. So what we're doing now is we're dealing with God and then those things ordered to the. And what the virtues are about is it's how we in our very, that's not the stomach, that's the soul. The I stands for intellect. The will stands for the soul's appetite, the will, the number of the soul and the body. Touch, so to speak, we have the sense appetites or the emotions. Those are the three fundamental types of powers that can be the subject of virtue within us. Why is that? It's because those powers, knowing, loving, and feeling, are not specified by one type of object. I can think about many things. I could study the truth of geometry. I could study the truth of physics. I could study the truth of a philosophy of Sacra Doctrina. As long as I study something that is real and knowable,
I can be specified by different types of sciences, different types of disciplines that have their own different types of objectivity. Therefore, a hometeus is what we have whenever a science or a thing known is known in a specific way. So the fact that the mind can know many things, that's why we go to school, law school, to get a degree in law, which is to say, I want to develop the hometeus, the habit, in this case a virtue, of law, and I need to have a virtue in my intellect because intellect is not specified as the law-knowing power. It can know anything. While we would not say that we don't train the eye to see color or light, because that's all that the eye does. You need habitus, habits. I know habitus is fourth declension, so the plural and the singular. It would be nice if it was habitus and then those habitis, but it's not. Singular and plural are both habitus. The reason why we have habitus, it's in those powers which are not specified by one cycle object. Now, with regard to their different types of power, capacity, as a wind-up, all of these powers, so I'm just going to get erase this, start not erasing God in the true sense, but let's say reality. God has given us the powers of intellect, willing, and feeling, sense apposition, as ways to engage being. And therefore, reality, and whatever is out there, whatever is real, activates our powers in different ways because of the different types of powers that there are. And so how does the intellect, how is it activated by reality? It's activated by things insofar as they are, insofar as they are being, therefore truth. How does reality activate the will? The will activates, the reality activates the will insofar as there is goodness. And the sense appetites activate, or reality activates the sense appetites insofar as they are sensibly good. All of these things, being in truth, that's in reality already. Goodness, that's in reality already. Sensible goodness, that's a part of aspects of reality. So whenever the human person comes to reality, in all dimensions, whether they be God, truth, marriage, sex, food, family, play, all things, we're engaging reality under these various aspects or formalities that are present. It's like to think of this. I'll come back to it. To give an illustration, this is very, this is my favorite illustration for my students at the Dominican House of Studies, just to show a distinction, begin to enter into it, and then we can begin to outline why there are these virtues. So let's imagine that it is, Good Friday. We had it not too long ago. Let's imagine that we're here meeting for this, and let's say we're walking in downtown Washington, D.C. Good Friday, as you might know, is a day of fasting. You don't eat meat on that day. And we walk past a wonderful place called Ruth's Chris Steakhouse. It's about 4 in the afternoon. Now, we've been fasting for a while, and the door opens, and we catch the aroma of marvelously cooking gifts from God called beef. And what happens immediately, our sensation picks up on something good. And it says, the concupiscible appetite says, hey, there is something good behind those doors. And what happens then is that the intellect comes down, says, yeah, okay, what's going on here? It says, there's something delicious behind those doors. And the intellect, you know, through the sight, and we understand, oh yeah, yeah, that's Ruth's Chris Steakhouse. That's called steak. That is delicious, but here's the thing, it's Good Friday. And what do the sense appetites metaphorically say? What's Good Friday? And the reason why they ask that is because why? Sense appetites, the emotions are powers that can only be activated by reality that is sensible, as sensibly good. And Good Friday-ness is real, but it's a spiritual reality. That's why they can't, it exceeds their objectivity.
Good Friday can be a direct object of those habits. So make another example. Let's imagine I did 11 years ago when I was a new priest in Manhattan, almost a million wedding preps. That was part of my job. In downtown Manhattan, all these people want to get married and they go to the priest. They try to work through them. And one of the things, most of them didn't know what they were doing because they, numb people today. But also, sadly, this is the church. We not a lot of catechesis. But let's say there were a few that knew, okay, marriage is important. I love my wife, love my husband. Well, let me chase it. We're going to have a happy marriage. And they would come back. This is not a confession. And a few of them, in awkward ways, would say, Father, I do love my wife, or I do love my husband, but I still find myself attracted to other people. I don't understand this. I said, it's going like this. You see, you're working at some corporate job in Manhattan. You love your wife or your husband. And all of a sudden, the most beautiful specimen of femininity or masculinity walks in. And what happens? This is good. And it ends up, it comes down again. What's going on? Oh, yeah, that's called a beautiful woman, or that's called, a handsome man. But see, there's a problem, the intellect says. What's that problem? That's not your wife or your husband. You're not married to that. And what do the sense appetites say? What's marriage? Because marriage is not a sensible reality. It's a spiritual. So what we're looking at then, by beginning with sense appetites, is saying we need virtues that can specify habitually, shape us with regard to feeling, with regard to willing, and with regard to knowing on their own respective level. That's what the virtues are. The virtues shape the powers of knowing, of loving, intellect, will, and feeling, sense, appetites, with regard to their activation by reality according to the different objectives. Here's sense goodness, here's any kind of goodness. Here is intelligibility. That's what the virtues do. So Professor Elias talked about the intellectual virtues. What we're doing here is we're looking at, you're trying to get the habit of, engineering or of law or of science or of physics or of philosophy. We're trying to shape the mind, understand the science, those sciences which reflect and participate in reality. With regard to the aspect of goodness, that's a habit. With regard to the moral virtue, which we're moving through now, justice is with regard to goodness, with regard to alterity, the goodness of another as other. Fortitude and temperance with regard to sensible goods and the alternative evil, dangers that come upon her. And last thing before we begin to move now and apply all of this, to why there have to be three philosophical virtues and four cardinal virtues is this, just to point out. Notice that there is a degree of overlap here. The will and the sense appetites are both appetites. Well, what kind of appetites are they? What distinguishes them? The sense appetite is an appetite that's activated by sensible goods. The will is an appetite which is activated by what's called universal goodness, which is any kind of goodness. So this is why, although the sense appetites can't bump up to sense, to desire the good of Good Fridays, fasting, because that's not sensible, only the will can do that, because Good Friday is a spiritual reality, or marriage is a spiritual reality, but the will, because it's objectivity, its object is any kind of goodness, it can be activated by spiritual and by sensible. So that's when you become a vicious, all of the, the Stoics and Aristotle and Aquinas talk about this. If the will is not in a governing, directing capacity and becomes the servant of sense desire in all cases, then you're on your way for a very vicious, disordered manner, because you literally have the higher power only and limited to always by its slave to what is only sensible goods, which, as we know, come and go with great rapidity.
But both the will and this and the emotions, the sense of appetites, our appetites is just the will can choose goodness, any kind of, just like a car, pick a card, any kind of car, any goodness at all, the will can be activated by. Only sensible goods can the emotion be activated.
Well, why is the intellect prudish? That's where the virtue of prudish resides. Why is it the highest? It's the highest because its objective range is the most three-dimensional. Goodness is broader than sense, or the will is broader than the sense appetites. Why? Sense appetites are activated by sensible goods. The will has a broader, has a two-dimensional, any kind of goodness, but it has to be good. The intellect can know and be activated by anything that is. So that means goodness, but also unity, but also existence, but also truth. The intellect, thus, is like the high-definition color power. It sees all colors on the screen in reality, in all of their dimensions. That's why it's the highest power. It's the helicopter power. It can look at anything. It can come down and see with the will, oh yeah, there's goodness here. I understand what goodness means. I know why you'd be excited about that. It can come down to the level of the sense appetite to say, oh yeah, that's sensible goodness. I understand that. They can't go up. They're limited to goodness. So if you think about the intellect, it's like high definition, full color TV knowledge. The will is like high definition, two colors, red, any kind of red, any type, whether it's a person or a tree or anything that's portrayed on the screen, the will can see it as long as it's red. And then the sense appetites are only red on one type of image. So you see this universality of the intellect and the appetites that gets further and further precise, made precise. And virtue, therefore, shapes all of them with regard to reality in these respective ways. So now, when Aquinas enters into his presentation of the cardinal virtues, we are after those virtues which perfect the human person with regard to these three powers. They're the fundamental virtues that perfect the human person with regard to these three powers. So with regard to the intellect, we have prudence, power of knowledge is perfected by prudence. Then you have the appetites, of which you have the will, which is perfected by justice, the virtue of justice. Then you have the sense appetites, which are perfected respectively by fortitude or courage, and temperance. These are the fundamental, pivotal, cardinal, that's the cardinal means, of course, hinge, pivotal virtues. So let's look at some highlights here. So in your reader, if you would turn these to page 106, we're just going to look at a few of the highlights and apply what we've talked about to what the text of Aquinas. Look at the ion. Now I'm breaking my rule for time. You know, I see you've got to look at all the objective and perspective literary, but we're just being just responsible. So don't tell anybody. Okay, I answer that. When we speak about virtue simply, this is Article 1, we are understood to speak of human virtue. Now, human virtue, as stated above, Question 56, Article 3, is one that answers to the perfect idea of virtue, which requires rectitude of the appetite. The appetite is well-ordered, well-directed. It is proportioned to, conformed to, even when it's not acting. The power is pointed to the end, the object that perfects and fulfills it.
For such like virtue does not only confers the faculty of doing well, but also causes the good deed to be done. When you and I become habituated to certain types of actions, they become, as Professor Elliott has already pointed out, connatural or second nature. Habits, whether virtuous, perfective, vicious, defective, or like a midway point in our very being between inactivity and activity. It's like we're already kind of active. We're almost there. To tell the truth, we don't have to tell the truth. We become habituated to. That's why the virtues are principles of action. That's why they cause a good deed to be done. On the other hand, the name virtue is applied to one that answers imperfect. So you have a perfect definition of virtue and an imperfect, imperfectly to the idea or ratio or virtue. And does not require rectitude of the appetite because it merely confers the faculty of doing well without causing the good deeds to be done. Remember our definition of virtue? That which makes the actor and his or her action good. Notice that in these two definitions, Aquinas identifying the perfection of the nature. When you have virtue, capital V, you don't just have the capacity for acting well, but the action is already almost there. You're going to do it. The imperfect notion, understanding, realization of virtue would be when you have the capacity, but the activation of that virtue is not guaranteed. Because it merely confers the faculty of doing well without causing the good deeds to be done. And then he says, now it is evident that the perfect is principle. The perfect in the sense of lacking nothing. The perfect is principle in the sense of first, as compared to the imperfect. And so those virtues which imply rectitude of the appetite are called principle virtues. This is what Professor Elliott's already talked about, the distinction between the moral virtues and the intellectual virtues. The cardinal virtues, the moral virtues, the ones we're talking about here, the ones we have listed here, they are more perfect than the virtues of art or intellectual virtue, science. Why is that? It's because if you have prudence, justice, fortitude, and temperance behind their very nature, you can't have it if you don't prudentially, justly, courageously, and temperate. But intellectual virtues, which are truly virtues, but they're less robust, they're less perfect. I can know how to do something, have a habit of counting, but just because I know it doesn't mean I have to do it. And if I don't do acts and counting, that doesn't mean that I have any less than knowledge of how to do it. The perfect, the complete, lacking nothing, nature of virtue is that first act and second act will be good. Intellectual virtues, or artistic habitus, those can shape first act. I could be a master, the screens, but I'm not necessarily going to do it. But with moral virtue, the cardinal virtues, first act and second act are both good. You can't be truly prudent if you don't act prudently. To give an example of this, there are three potential parts, less fancy words, don't worry about that, but let's say the three steps of prudence. There's what's called counsel, so it's held in judgment, and there's what's called command, or better in contemporary English, we say execution. What is prudence about? It's about right reason with regard to what I should do. There are three steps. Seek counsel. So let's say I have to make a decision. The first step is to ask friends or acquaintances or resources that have more experience, knowledge than I, of what they would do or have done or would do in the situation I currently am. Look, if you're probably wise to me, you have a different insight because of your experience. I'm gonna ask you. I have to ask for some counsel. Now, it's important for me to get counsel. The foolish man or woman says, I don't need to ask anybody. I figure it out. Or even my parents, speaking of me, this is how I live my early life. I approach this, but they say I didn't seek counsel. very often. So it's important to seek counsel. But we've known people like this. You can't just stick with counsel yet. We've had people like this. They're perpetual discerners. Hey, I haven't met you yet. Hey, you look like a man that's wise. Should I get married or should I be a priest? What do you think? You're the grocer. I mean, literally, you're the grocer. You think I look like a priest? And it's like, okay, you've asked the 1,000, 1,400, whatever. And you seek a staking counsel. Counsel is important as a step, potential part of prudence, but you need the other one too. And what's the second step? That's called judgments, whereby you take the counsel you've received and you, with your own practical reason, make a determination that this is what is good for here and me. Either in reference to what you've heard, against it, with it, you make a determination, you process. And some people are good at this too. They'll take counsel from a couple people, wise people, they'll make a determination, and then they go sit on the couch and say, yeah, I know what I've got to do, but I'll do that tomorrow. And a year passes. Or is you going to law school? Yeah, I'll be there tomorrow. Next year, I missed the exam. Because the final and ultimate determining step in prudence is command or execution. You have to do what you determine. So that's just an example within prudence of the fact that no one is prudent if they're great at counsel but can't do judgment. No one is truly prudent if they're great at counsel and even judgment but can't do command. The most important, the most formal, the most specifying act of the virtue, the moral virtue, the cardinal virtue of prudence is command, because that's when it moves from first act to second act, the actually do it. That's what Aquinas is talking about here. Those virtues which imply rectitude of the appetite are called principal virtues. Such are the moral virtues and prudence alone of the intellectual virtues, for it is also something of a moral virtue. Why does he emphasize the appetite here? It's because the appetites are ordered to goodness and they move us towards the end. The appetites are the moving power. So if you think of appetite and knowledge, they work in the two different directions. Knowledge pulls in. When I know what a rock is, through a series of dematerialization called abstraction, I have the image of a rock. I know something. I possess something when I know. But love, or the appetite, is the power that moves outwards. And that's why you're so principled, because with regard to the human life, I erase, oh, here it is. The whole of the human life is one of moving towards an end, which is good. And so for virtue to have a capital V, it has to be a virtue that touches inherently and necessarily upon the appetites, because the appetites are towards goodness, and goodness is the power that draws us. We're moving. Okay. Then he says, look at Article 2 here, that same question. We're not going to read everything, but these just look at the highlights. So, Article 2, I answer that. Things may be numbered. So he's asking whether there are four cardinal virtues. He says, things may be numbered either in respect of their formal principles or according to the subjects in which they are. Subjects here be top. And either way, we find that there are four cardinal virtues. I love this article. For the formal principle of the virtue of which we speak now is good as defined by reason. Why is reason always emphasized with the virtues? It's because we've already said, it's because Aurelius has said, virtue bespeaks perfective order. And the intellect is the power that recognizes order. It's the power that can look at the terrain and say, oh, this would be lead for that. This requires that. The intellect is the helicopter power. That's why for any act of virtue, it has to be rational, not because Aquinas was a big brain guy and likes thinking, but because the intellect is the power that can recognize, plan, conceive, and also avoid disorder, but recognize order. It can see purposes. It can see finalities. So now, getting down into the final, or at least you may not have paragraphs, but the next section. So, which good is considered in two ways? So goods can be considered in two ways. First, as existing in the very act of reason itself. And thus we have one principal virtue called prudence. Prudence is the order, the virtue, the goodness of reason with regard to human action. Remember, we need to have goodness. All the moral virtues have to touch on goodness. And so what prudence does is it perfects, it is good for the practical intellect, the intellect that and insofar as it acts. Second, according as the reason puts its order, which it has in prudence, into something else. An application of order. Either into operations, which is justice, relations and actions order with regard to things outside of us or apart from us. That's the virtue of justice. Virtuous order applied with regard to others, justice. Or into the passions. And then we need two virtues. For the need of putting the order of reason into the passions is due to their thwarting of reason. And this occurs in two ways. We all know emotions can frustrate clear thought. First, by the passions inciting to something against reason. And then the passions need a curb, which we call temperance. So the snake in Good Friday, or the beautiful person who's not your spouse, those are truly goods. This is very important. Sometimes we think Catholics, we have to think that, no, that's evil, and I'm only about the good. No, the reason why you're drawn to steak or to a beautiful person is because beauty is good and steak, of course, is good. The problem is that it's not a universal good. It's not a good in an absolute or unqualified sense. That's why the emotions, the sense advocates, are not themselves the ultimate barometer or metric or instrument of determination about what I should do, because I'm called to pursue and consider good as in the big picture. That's why we rely on the intellect. If you look at that, you're the student of Eshi. Second, so yeah, we don't beat down the emotion to be order. If let's say, oh, steak is good, yeah, that's a beautiful woman, that's a handsome man, that's not your husband or not your spouse, it's not good writing. And we will only be perfected by acting for these nonsensible things, marriage, Good Friday, etc. And the sense appetites are met. Oh, God's grace, at bars. They're not like rabid dogs that are always fighting us. They're like little puppies. They get excited. They don't know what's going on, but they're not evil. And they do want to follow the direction of it. The master, which is nearly what they do. Beautiful. But we'll go with that pervert. That's the truth and not the emotion. Second, by the passions withdrawing us. So temperance with regard to those goods that draw us that are sensible. The passion of withdrawing fortitude from the by the passions withdrawing us from following the dictate of reason, e.g., for example, through fear of danger or toil. And then a man needs to be strengthened for that which reason dictates, lest he turn back. And to this end, there is fortitude. If temperance is about goods that we need to measure and order properly with regard to our age drawn, fortitude deals with those goods or those absences of goods and those dangers. Okay, I don't want to face this difficult. We need both. So look at the last sentence. It's a long sentence of this article. For there are four subjects of the virtue we speak of now. Viz, which is an operative abbreviation, Vitalitia, which means namely, the power which is rational in its essence, and this is perfected by prudence, and that which is rational by participation, and is threefold. The will, which is the subject of the power that is shaped by justice, the concupiscible faculty, the subject that's shaped by temperance, and the irascible faculty, the subject shaped by fortitude. We notice that Aquinas is moving with regard to the powers, with regard to their own different types of objectivity, how they're activated, and the different things, the different material principles, the different contexts that require virtue. So if the concupiscible appetite is the sense appetites activated by sensible goods, there are different kinds of sensible goods. There's the good of food, there's the good of drink, and there's the good of physical intellect. So you need virtues that can specify those different types of goods. And within those powers, however, we have the cardinal virtues, and from all the other virtues, and there are many, in the secunda of the Summa Theologiae, the second of the second parts, he goes through and shows like a taxonomy, and there's art, it's beautiful. The trees are virtues, they're all connected, but these are the first and the foundational. Okay. Let us now turn to, okay, just a brief pause, Article 5 of this question, 61. Just in case you think I got a little excited yesterday about exemplar causality in the law, I deny. And I cite, look at, this is the last article of that question, Article 5, question 61, under the respondeo. This comes back to your good questioning about whether someone needs to know. So I answer that says, as Augustine says, we can skip that, not because we don't like Augustine, but because of the time. Okay, consequently, the exemplar of human virtue must needs pre-exist in God, just as in him pre-exists the types, the natures of all things. Accordingly, virtue may be considered as existing originally in God, and thus we speak of exemplar virtues. So that in God, here we're back, the divine mind itself may be called prudence, while temperance is the turning of God's gaze on himself, even as in us it is that which conforms the appetite to reason. God's fortitude is his unchangeableness, his justice is the observance of the eternal law in his works, as the insightful Zionist music. What we mean by this is that God, when he created the human person with human nature, or himself as supernatural end, knows what falls within human nature, namely the different powers, intellect, will, sense, appetites, and what perfects them and what does not. This is not a narrow conception of virtue. We have great freedom. But it is a clear and specifying conception of virtue because God knows, let's say, the will to be perfected by goodness and not by evil. But there are many kinds of goodness. So God knows not the will and human nature to be perfected by dishonest or by truth-telling. But that doesn't mean that God has, I have the one type of action or one type of life you should live in. I know it this way. You've got to find it. No. Because what God, truth, goodness, has a great plurality. So there's a great creativity in the virtues, even while it conforms to how God knows the world to be and what human nature requires, because virtue is how you and I personally, suppositively, so to speak, hypostatically, individually, enter into the goodness of reality in our own way. So don't think that we say that God knows certain things to be perfect and not. There's just one way we'll do what? No, there's a corrupted, there's goodness, it's probably there. Okay? All right. Then we get to the theological virtues. The theological virtues are distinct from the moral virtues because the moral virtues are about things other than God. They are about the things that are ordered to God or orderable to God. The theological virtues have all of them God for the object. And this is why there are only three theological virtues, not four. And also why, notice very interestingly, as you saw in the reading, there's no theological virtue in the sense of our time. It's only intellect and faith in the intellect,
mainly the intellect, with thought activating the intellect supernaturally. That's the BLF virtue of faith. Open charity, our God is object in different ways, activating the will supernaturally. Why does there no theological virtue of the sense apparatus? Why is that impossible? It's impossible because the very nature of the sense appetites can't be activated by God, can't have that other object, there's their object, because God's not sensible, and they're only activated by sensible goods.
So Article 1, Question 62. Whether there are any theological virtues. And this is in the respond, or the I answer that. Man is perfected by virtue for those actions whereby he is directed to happiness, to beatitude, as was explained above. Then he says something that is show-stopping. He says, now man's happiness is twofold, as was stated above. One is proportionate to human nature, a happiness to wit, which man can obtain by means of his natural principles. That's one type of happiness to which we are truly inclined and ordained. The other is a happiness surpassing man's nature, and which man can obtain by the power of God alone, by a kind of participation in, or we have here, of the Godhead. 2 Peter 1:4, we are made partakers of the divine nature. And because such happiness surpasses the capacity of human nature, man's natural principles, which enable him to act well according to his capacities, do not suffice to direct man to this same happiness, because it's beyond our capacity. I can't direct something to myself, something which is, by definition, beyond my capacity to achieve. Hence, it is necessary for man to receive from God, and now we're getting to the theological virtues, some additional principles, some superadded principles, whereby he may be directed to supernatural happiness, even as he is directed to his connatural, we could say natural end, by means of his natural principles, albeit not without divine assistance. Note that. That's good. We'll conclude our session this morning with that, because that's grace, the divine assistance. But such like principles are called theological virtues. Here's what theological virtues are. He gives us the points. First, because their object is God. God is the one activating the powers of knowing and love, intellect and love, inasmuch as they direct us aright to God. Second, because they are infused in us by God alone. They come within us. They shake our being only by God, not because we've done them. Pache, our dear friends of the former generation, Luis de Aquilina. Only God can give. There's no such thing as a natural faith, really. That's the Buddha. Third, because these virtues are not made known to us save by divine revelation contained in Holy Writ. So what makes the theological virtues distinct? They are God-oriented and God-directed. It's God activating the intellect and the will, the rational appetite, directly and properly and supernaturally. Now look at the response. I answer that to Article 2. Actually, even look at the said contrary. This is very helpful. On the contrary. That which is above man's nature is distinct from that which is according to his nature. But the theological virtues are above man's nature, while the intellectual and moral virtues are in proportion. They're on the same level. They're accessible to his nature. Therefore, they are distinct from one another. And then continuing, I answer that. As stated above, habits, habitus, are specifically distinct from one another in respect of the formal difference of their objects.
back to that's why we spent that time with Elliot Haswell on the nature of objectivity. Now, the object of the theological virtues is God himself, who is the last end of all, as surpassing the knowledge of our reason. Remember, similar analysis to what we saw in question one, article one, yes, of the creed of ours. On the other hand, the object of the intellectual and moral virtues is something comprehensible to human reason. Wherefore, the theological virtues are specifically distinct from the moral and intellectual virtues. To summarize, what he's doing here, and this is, I would say, very relevant, not just important for philosophy and theology, but also relevant to work in the public sphere, the public world, is that he has connected the virtues to finality as God. All the virtues are ordered to God. Also, because as we said during our discussion, the infinite God is the extrinsic common good of all reality. So even the couple of virtues are ordered to God. But the distinction is that God is, he's one thing, God, but he can be two types of objectives. He can be two types of objects. This is to say that God is our natural end and our supernatural end. It is proper to reason and even to the order of rational natures to make inquiry into the first cause, which is to say, it is natural to all rational beings to desire God, the one thing, as our natural end. But that natural end needs as our creator, and because he's our creator, he's our destination. And if you had a whole time, where you probably already know a lot of this, I'm sure, what is the kind of contiguous, all of the virtue, all the whole virtue, man, let's talk him in eight. They're very sad. But they're all ordered to God as natural end. Which is why, back to our Americans, for Thomas, anytime a law or a governor or a system of political structure would argue that God or religion is actually harmful for society, we say, ah, because what you're saying is that law, which is ordered to virtue, to peace, to the common good, is actually inimical to God as a natural end, which is something the human person requires and needs for their natural fulfillment. This is impossible. Now, what Aquinas is talking about here is that God is not just our natural end. We aren't just interested in contemplating God's desire to save on the outside as first cause. But God, in his goodness with grace, has invited us to come within. Father, Son, Holy Spirit, supernatural yet. And this is how God is both our natural end, first cause, and our supernatural end. Yeah, beatific vision, habit, seeing God from the inside, so to speak. But the dash God's natural end, his supernatural end, are not the same. It says the same thing, just like seeing rock with Kevin, but seeing the law, he's hastening the robber to the same types of acts. Desiring God naturally, which is the order of what the mind is all about, or desiring God supernaturally, or two types of ways that they activate by saying God. And while your profession is subordinate, we use impatient, right? I'm very much the adversary outside, but is engaging and preserving the human capacity of applying even a natural point, order to God as a natural end, which cannot save, but is essential. It's impossible to be ordered to God as supernatural end without also being ordered in the natural. So even though it's not enough to go to heaven, have God as natural end, it's absolutely essential to have God as to understand the heavens is both realizing union with God as natural and as supernatural end. Okay, in the remaining 10 minutes, or the last thing, Professor Elliot, by the way, so he is the expert cobbling the world on the theological virtue of hope. So that's very nice. We're very blessed to have it. But hope is very interesting because you have one theological virtue in the intellect
and two in the web, hope and charity.
Charity, of course, has God and his goodness for the sake of God.
Hope has the goodness of God with regard to me individually. That's the fundamental distinction. However, so Pastor Awe can say more about that.
All right, so we come to grace, and we will give grace the short shrift because I got carried away. And in fact, I'm looking at my thing, I forgot the pay went. Question 109 talks about grace is necessary. And the reason why it's necessary are twofold. One is with regard to first act, and one is with regard to second act. What do I mean by that? The code name, the cheat code for grace, the phrase in the Summa for grace is divine help. When you see divine help, that is grace. Now, we'll still use the word gracia to talk, about grace. He says divine health, he's talking about grace. That's why at the end of the journal prologue, which you look at, he evidently said, I'm relying upon divine help. I'm going to try to write this Summa.
That's very common. Top massive for the grace of use. And there are two types of grace on the members. There's grace which moves us, and there's grace which inheres within us. Grace which moves us and grace which inheres within us. The grace which inheres within us, of course, is the supreme and the ultimate, the central. That's what we would call sanctifying or habitual grace. That makes us in our being grace. Our intellect and our will become conformed to, habituated to, shaped by the divine life and being. And therefore, when I exist, I have the habit, the habitus, of sanctifying grace within my soul, I'm able to act in a supernatural manner. And that's why, to make acts of faith, hope, and charity, supernatural virtues, I have grace in my soul.
You remember, grace pertains to the essence of the soul. So again, that's not stomach, that's open day. See that? All right. Grace fills up the whole soul, sanctifying grace, habitual grace. And the virtues are the state from grace, the theological virtues, they follow on because what it is, think of the theological virtues as the overflow of grace into the powers of intellect and will, which the soul has. A grace, habitual grace, is the grace which shapes the being of the soul, making it conform to God. And therefore, first act, because I exist in a diapodic way, I'm able to act the theistic way. God, you lost your vision. But it's not enough. One of the things Thomas brings up, you can't get into it here, is that for all motion, and motion is just the words Thomas used, Aquinas used to talk about change, you need God moving you to move yourself. This applies to the bird, natural. So there's a bird I'm sure flying somewhere around here. That bird is being moved by God as first cause right now. The flap is wings and breathe or make noise and milk with ear. But is that bird a puppet on a string? No, that bird is doing what birds, it itself is doing those actions of flock. Likewise for us, my heart beating, is my heart doing that? Yes. But is God causing my heart to move? Yes. This is the great mystery in grace. Aquinas is always emphasizing that God is 100% the cause of every motion insofar as it's good. And those things that are changed or moved or act are also 100% the cause of their motion. And on the level of grace, this is the great mystery in the future Capricorn.
Look at Grace, who wants to really have a trolley horse between years. It's really remarkable. But what Aquinas teaches about grace is this. Not only is grace something that changes our being, but when it comes to causality, God is the highest cause and the first cause. He is also the cause. But God is more cause than we are. Last thing, the teaching of Aquinas is this. Human freedom on the supernatural level is a cause of freedom. Which means that if I do something good, activate my freedom for God supernaturally in grace manner, God is causing me to freely do it. And the reason why that must be an end here is that my good actions, my free actions have to be caused by God, unless we want to say there are some real things that are good that don't have God for the cause. And that's a problem that I say, but because then there is no other God. If good free actions of a supernatural nature are real and they are good, and all goodness comes from God, God in some way must be the cause of my freedom.
That's what he set this up for. And if we were to continue to look at grace in an in-depth manner, which I know we're not, we would see how divine causality and how human causality are enacted in the acts of the Lord Jesus. All right, glory be to the Father, and to the Son, and to the Holy Spirit.
Like the beginning, there's an hour to the world without
anything. Thank you for listening to Ordain and Establish. Subscribe to our podcast, and if you'd like to learn more, visit our website at cit.catholic.edu.